Joe Corsello.
A couple of comments. First of all, let me second what Jay said. I think it's an excellent point. My sense from both when I was in practice many years ago but in talking to practitioners now, the firms develop these checklists. They have third or fourth year people go through them. They look to make sure the disclosures are there. They look to maybe get comfortable with the numbers. But I don't think that a lot's done around the words. And the words are what really tell the story. And so I think that's something for the board to think about. The second comment is, when I saw that this topic was on the agenda, I thought it might be useful to offer some unique data. Academics like unique data. And so what I did is I took all of your inspection reports that had been issued from day one through February of 2011, 10,511 pages, and I looked to see how often disclosure deficiencies were found by you. And so let me give you the number, and then I'll give two hypotheses around the number, okay? 16, this is the big four. 16 across the big four. Now, there's four firms, 7 years. This is 2003 to 2009 inspections. I say, let's assume that at each big four inspection, you take 50 clients. That's just the number I used. So if you multiply all that out, that's 1,400. 16 across a base of 1,400, that's around 1%. So here's the two hypotheses, right? One hypothesis is that the issuers and the auditors are doing a spectacular job, and that's why there's only a 1% hit rate. The other hypothesis is you're not doing as good a job as in this area as maybe you can be doing. Not you, Marty, not your group, but this is more broadly for the board.
Yeah, some other group, not us.
Some other group. But the five board members oversee everybody. You know, this is something I think to think about. And one of the things I found telling, and this ties into Denny's comment, that on an audit committee, he doesn't get, I think one firm gives him a schedule of past disclosures, the others don't. I won't embarrass the firm, but one of the big four firms, in their response, and this is now a quote, more than half of the exceptions noted related to presentation and disclosure matters. Like, oh, that's a sin, but it's a minor sin. And I think that's how we've often viewed this, is disclosure as a second-class citizen. And I think given the trend in FASB standards over the last 10, 15 years, if not longer, where disclosure is now more integral to the standard than in the past, where it might have been 2 to 3 paragraphs at the very end, I think we need to give equal attention to disclosure issues as we give recognition and measurement issues.
Good point. Wayne Collins?
Thank you. It seems to me that developing standards for assessing the adequacy of disclosure is quite like developing standards for how to evaluate an impressionist painting. You know, there's so many nuances. And if you look at the 50-plus pages or the 150 pages, whatever it is, of disclosures, these are individual disclosures, granular disclosures. This doesn't really get back to say, well, does the whole picture really portray what reality is? And you've got now the new objective-based requirements, which pretty much mirror, I guess, the concept statement about what is deemed to be material for a reasonable user of the financial statements. It's a very, very broad requirement and difficult to implement. And from an audit standpoint, it's even more difficult without the framework in place from the preparer standpoint. So hearing that the FASB does have a project underway for disclosure framework, I think it would be well to have that project get underway and have the PCB work with the FASB in terms of the auditing concepts that would go into it, rather than having a parallel project initiated from the auditing standpoint. I mean, this is initially a preparer issue that then needs to be audited.
I think that's a good point, and we are certainly very interested in the FASB disclosure framework project. So point well taken, Wayne. Thanks.
Arch, Archamo.
Some others have teed up a little bit of what I was going to talk about as well. I mean, certainly disclosures over the years have become increasingly complex, and the extent of the judgment required in terms of what goes into those disclosures has become more complex. Wayne just mentioned this aspect of the new standards, and there's a quote here in your document referring to the revenue proposed standard that says, in connection with disclosures, if the entity has not met the disclosure objective of the particular standard, then the entity shall disclose whatever additional information is necessary to meet that objective. Well, that's certainly going to, you talk about challenges, that's certainly going to increase the challenge on the preparers and the auditors to be, when they're looking at that aspect of disclosures. The other thing I wanted to mention was this paper that Scott brought up from the IAASB. It lays out a lot of the issues, I think, in a very orderly and nice way, in a complete way, about the evolving nature of financial reporting and the disclosure and the audit implications. There's a series of consultation questions that are specifically addressed to preparers, investors, regulators, and auditors. And I didn't mention this before, but I serve on the IAASB, and we are certainly hoping for some robust responses from all of those groups to help us in this. And I know that, Marty, that with the relationship and that you all have, and you follow the IAASB activities, you'll keep on top of this. We'll certainly be providing input to you as we get responses there. But it does cover a lot of things with the complexity of this. From a standpoint of the standards themselves, they're always something that have to be considered. But when I look at the risk-based standards and the way that you've laid out in your standards the disclosure aspect of a risk assessment, my initial reaction is that those risk standards currently are pointing the auditors to where they need to go, what they need to be considering with respect to disclosures. Now, maybe there's some implementation guidance that you might offer up in the future, depending upon what types of things you're seeing that your inspections group are running across. But conceptually, I think the risk-based standards are pointing us in the right direction.
That's good to hear. And yes, we are well aware of, as you indicated, the IAASB project as well, and I've read that paper, and we'll be staying close to responses you get to the consultation paper, et cetera, and take that into account. Thanks for that.
Barbara Roper.
As I've been listening to this discussion, it occurs to me that the comment that I had in mind when I started may be slightly off point, because I was thinking about this in terms of auditing the financial statements as opposed to auditing the financial statement disclosures, and it's not always clear to us outsiders exactly what you all mean by your specific terms. But the requirement that the financial statements include whatever information necessary to make them not misleading, I think, provides enough of a hook for my comments that I'm going to go ahead and make them anyway, which is that as we increasingly move toward more subjective and more standards and more use of judgment, it places a premium on auditors' willingness and ability to exercise independent judgment and to show professional skepticism in how they assess the adequacy of these financial statement disclosures. And as you know, I think the FSA in the recent crisis commented on the worrying lack of professional skepticism that they had found in the audits of a number of large financial institutions. And so I think that in turn raises the issue. It puts a premium on auditor independence, and that you can't sort of separate, if you want to get toward effective disclosure, if you want to get toward good financial reporting and good sound audits, it's not just about auditing standards. It is about independence and what we're going to do finally at some point to make the auditors truly independent in this process.
Doug Carmichael.
Words are very important, and I was poring over the words and some of the standards you give as examples. And one of them says, if financial statements, including accompany notes, fail to disclose information that is required by generally accepted accounting principles, then you do something. And the modern version of that is, for a fair presentation of the financial statements in conformity with the applicable financial reporting framework. Now, either of those phrases lead to looking at it in terms of, are all the disclosures there that are required by the accounting pronouncements? And it's really necessary to counteract that very directly by the words that are used. The notion that is in the auditing standard on what fair presentation and conformity with GAAP means, saying that it means that you include all the information necessary for a user to really understand what's going on, that's a paraphrase, of course, is the right notion, but you don't find that concept in the accounting standards. And I think it's nice that the FASB is working on a disclosure framework, but I think we need, as soon as possible, a very simple accounting standard that states the basic bottom line on the need for the step-back evaluation to tell the story. That needs to be part of the accounting standards. And it shouldn't take a really long time to do. You don't need an elaborate disclosure framework to put that into the accounting standards and make it an operational requirement for auditors instead of the way it's interpreted usually now as a long checklist to see whether all the points in the accounting pronouncements have been covered.
I think that's a very good point, and that I think that's the essence of the discussion we're trying to get into here, is that auditing financial statements and then related disclosures, is it a compliance exercise of because of the way the standards, accounting standards, are set up, or are auditing standards appropriate such that the auditor does step back to determine that the financial statements and all the disclosures tell the entire story? But I think it gets to the point of sort of Denny's comment to begin this all off with, and that is, sometimes it seems like the disclosures are sort of a checklist afterthought as opposed to a comprehensive framework in terms of here's what disclosures should do as part of the financial statements. And I wonder, Larry, if it's a good time to turn to you. There have been a number of comments about that, and I don't know if your point's on that or not.
My points weren't directly on that, but first of all, our consideration of disclosures doesn't occur at 23 and a half hours. It's 21 and a half. But I guess what I'm reading into the suggestion by Doug is that you would like some type of a materiality framework to evaluate whether the disclosures that are required but might be missing effectively, so that people can evaluate whether the lack of that disclosure is really material to the users of financial statements. At least that's what I hear you, something like that. Is that what you're after?
Yeah, something like that. It would evaluate whether the information is important. Let me just tell the short story that a lot of people are familiar with. We have, as the law of the land in the United States today, a case called U.S. versus Simon. And we have the U.S. versus Simon decision that says effectively professional standards aren't a complete defense because in that case, a company called Continental Vending loaned money to an affiliate, Valley Stream, and Valley Stream in turn loaned money, that same money, to the president of Continental Vending, and that wasn't disclosed in the financial statements. A very young U.S. attorney, Peter Fleming Jr., brought a case against the auditors in that circumstance. The lead partner on the engagement, Carl Simon, is the Simon in U.S. versus Simon. And at that time, there were 8 large firms, and the managing partners of 7 of the 8 firms, the 7 not being the one involved, all came into court and testified that disclosure of those related party transactions was not required by generally accepted accounting principles. As a result, Judge Friendly, in making the appellate decision, had to come forward and say, well, it's not important what GAAP requires. It's important that there be fair disclosure. And adherence to the accounting standards, the fact that GAAP didn't require that disclosure, is really not a defense. And we've got that now as the law of the land because of that very narrow view of what adequate disclosure is, that adequate disclosure merely means have you ticked off that it's required by an accounting pronouncement. And I think it would be important to have an accounting pronouncement that stated that as part of GAAP, you have this very basic disclosure responsibility to evaluate whether the information is there that a reasonable investor would be interested in.
Okay, can I follow up on that then? Because that leads me to a couple of the other points that I had. And we've had people suggest to us that we should write a standard on materiality, which might go beyond what you're just suggesting. So let me take that back and we'll mull over it. But it's interesting that what you're suggesting we do is the absolute opposite of what Arch just said was a problem with the little synopsis of the revenue recognition standard. So I find it interesting that the two of you are totally citing things that we should consider, and they're at opposite ends of the spectrum, because and part of the problem is that a lot of the summaries or the quotes that have been taken relative to our recent disclosure requirements have been taken out of context. Okay, the implication is that that's all we required, and that's not the case. In revenue recognition, yes, we did add that little provision in there, in addition to a number of required disclosures, and we added it because revenue recognition methodologies, et cetera, are so diverse and transactions are so diverse, we didn't know if we would adequately cover what would be useful information to users. So we added that general provision in terms of look at the disclosures, look at the objectives, and see if the disclosures you've made accomplish those objectives. And if not, you might want to consider disclosing something else. I mean, it's a fairly simple concept. Likewise, in terms of the disclosures about not putting too much in but not putting too little in that Denny and both Dan cited earlier, you should realize that that provision is in documents that include a number of specific disclosure requirements. So, in other words, we gave you what we thought should be disclosed, but we can't tell you, you know, how to aggregate or disaggregate things in terms of, you know, whether you're communicating useful information to users of financial statements. So those are the two comments I have to make. And then I just want to give you an observation, and whether you consider this if you move forward with any kind of a disclosure standard or not, since there are a number of auditors here, you might want to hear what we've heard at a couple of our observer or roundtable type meetings that we have with constituent groups. And I'll at least summarize the group so you can understand the context in which the statements were made. But both when we met with representatives of Nakubo, which is an organization of business officers of universities and colleges, and when we met with our own not-for-profit advisory committee, which is a newly formed committee consisting of a bunch of not-for-profit people, they have told us in our discussions about disclosures that their auditors are preventing them from making disclosures in their financial statements if the disclosures are not required by GAAP. And I've sat in those meetings and heard that with dismay, because I can't understand how an auditor can prevent somebody from disclosing something as long as it's not material inconsistent with the financial statements. But I just throw that out for you to consider, you know, in your own respective shops. I did not.
Okay, Nary Buxpan.
Thank you. A few observations. First, I concur.
Can you first refute on my behalf, Larry's?
Oh, your behalf? without getting into that, what I would like to do is just speak to couple topics. First, I agree with the earlier observations of trees versus forest and what disclosures should do. But what I think we are somewhat need to, and that goes back to Scott's earlier comment about an auditing framework as contrasted with the accounting framework. So accounting framework is one issue. And interestingly enough, when Larry mentioned earlier the ITAC comment letter and suggestion for the disclosure framework, which Lynn and myself were intimately involved with through the ITAC, and one of the areas that actually triggered that was exactly the pension disclosures, that you get 10 or 15 pages of pension disclosures around FAS 138 or any successor that's highly granular. And then you look at a company that may not be the most significant element. You still get the 15 pages, but you have no idea what assumptions and estimates are built into the return provisions, warranty provisions. It could be much more significant to a user than the pension. And the same goes to IOs under FAS 140 and other elements. You can get pages and pages, but then you step back and say, however, this is not the most the largest risk, and there may be many things on those financial statements that smell the same, feel the same, but you don't get the same level of disclosure. So what I encourage the accounting framework to think about is, do you apply equal weight, and under what circumstances and why, and could you instill some conceptual rhyme and reason to this analogy? Which takes me to the auditing discussion, which I thought is the topic of today's discussion, and I just jotted down a few elements, and I think we're talking about disclosures, and sometimes it's muddy, the discussion, and I just kind of broke disclosures to their elements. And in my view of disclosure, I may have been missing some elements. There are a few elements in disclosures, and each one can call to different auditing techniques. It's simply the tools or techniques that could be used to audit those. And this clearly falls within could be a conceptual framework to auditing of disclosure that I will distinguish from the conceptual framework to manufacturer disclosures. And what I wrote down here is, first in disclosure, what we normally found is simply replacements for number in the financial statements. So the financial statements saying stock-based compensation is going to be reported based on X, and in the footnotes you report based on Y. So if those are substitutional numbers, fair value versus historical cost, the same notion, and it shouldn't be a second-class citizen, as was mentioned earlier, the same technique should apply. Then there are some explanation of simply numbers. This could be roll-forward schedules or some breakdown of numbers. I would think, again, I haven't been auditing for a long period of time, but I think you apply the same auditing technique to those sub-numbers, because all they are sub-numbers. The third element is explanatory language of amounts. Those are generally explaining the numbers in the financial statements. There should be some framework applied to how auditors need to think about this explanatory language. Then there's another element that speaks to estimates and assumptions. What are the estimates and assumptions that underpin the financial statement information? You should apply another audit techniques to that. And the last item on my list is some elements of forward-looking statements that has some notion of MD&A and some other things, but some of it finds its way into financial statement disclosure, including the notion of going concern that was discussed here earlier. So I think if you go through this listing, you simply apply different audit techniques. You make clear what those audit techniques are. You see what fits a particular circumstance under you, some conceptual framework, and you provide the auditors with some guidance that can be monitored. I think discussing the disclosures and painting them in broad brush sometimes muddy those elements. So I would encourage you to kind of dissect disclosure to their element rather than addressing them as a single reference.
Sam Renzilla.
Well, Nary, I think you did that without taking a breath. Well, let me try to. let me just try catch up on a couple of things. First, this IAASB discussion paper, I think, is a really good piece of work, and I think it'll be a significant loss, a missed opportunity on the part of this board if it doesn't actively get involved in that process, because I think that it is asking all the right questions around disclosure and the auditor's involvement around those disclosures. Second piece, I'm going to take exception to a couple of comments that were made by some of the members with respect to that the disclosures of public company, that the audits of disclosures of public companies are been delegated down to our junior people. That is absolutely not true in my experience. I will agree with you that the somewhere between 50 and 150 page disclosure checklist, that the first shot at that is a younger person, a senior accountant, but the majority of the time spent on the most significant elements of the disclosures is by the most senior members of the team, and that includes the engagement quality reviewer, the lead audit partner, and the manager on the account. So I don't want, at least from my experience, to say that disclosures have been delegated down to young people the same way that bank reconciliations and the testing of those are done by younger people. I think that is a misstatement of the current state of the auditing profession. I'll try to respond to Larry Smith's comment, and I don't know which group this was. Are these people that prepare financial statements for that are public companies?
No, these are not for profit, primarily not for profits.
Okay, well, I'm not familiar with it, but I would suggest that maybe the information that is being that the auditors are telling them not to include is one of two things. One, it's not auditable, and therefore it's not appropriate to include in financial statements. Or two, maybe it's not supportable and ought not to be disclosed as well. But I'm not aware that auditors are keeping public companies from providing disclosures. Maybe somebody has a view on that, but it's not my experience. The last thing, I'll try to respond to the first question. I think this is sort of going to put me in the category of the master of the obvious, but what are the challenges in auditing? The challenges in auditing disclosures are not around completeness in terms of line item by line item, going through the 50 to 150 pages. That those are not the challenges in auditing disclosures. The challenges, in my view, around auditing disclosures are really in two buckets. The first is the quality and the understandability of the subjective disclosures, and those are the ones that are primarily around what risks and what measurement uncertainty is left in the financial statements after the preparer has done its work and the auditor has done their work. There's still significant measurement uncertainty, and a lot of the disclosures that both the SEC and the FASB require are an attempt for management to provide that information to the users of the financial statements. And I think those are clearly the most difficult ones for us to audit. The second one is sort of a materiality test. So an entity makes a disclosure that you want one of two situations. A disclosure is made that is, in the view of the auditor, inadequate, or a disclosure is omitted that an auditor believes ought to be included in there. And I think a real challenge that we have is When we look at that and we accumulate that information, does that cause the financial statements to be materially misstated, taken as a whole, which is the ultimate test that the auditor has to reach in order to conclude and issue an unqualified auditor's report? And I think those are the two areas that auditors, when they go through disclosures, those are the two biggest challenges that they have.
Thanks for those comments, and maybe the latter one can be helped with our next project we're going to talk about the auditor's report and enabling the auditor to talk more about the quality of the financial statements. So that's a possible benefit of that project on that second problem you pointed out. But thanks for that input, Sam.
Diana Hillier.
Thank you. I won't repeat what others have said about IAASB's disclosure project. I do thank those who have complimented the discussion paper, and we certainly are looking forward to a very active and lively debate. I did just want to reflect on a couple of things, because I think it's themes that have come out in a number of the discussions today. One of the objectives in that discussion paper, and part of the reason for asking the questions to investors, preparers, regulators, and others, was when we were reaching out and doing liaison meetings last year and talking to people, we kept hearing that auditors aren't necessarily doing the job they were expected to be doing with respect to disclosures. But the underlying reasons that we were heard were diametrically opposed and often conflicting. And it suggests that we do need to be engaging with the preparers, the accounting standard setters, the regulators, and others to discuss these issues, to get a consensus view about how we address them. How do we apply materiality? What is a misstatement in a disclosure? How do we evaluate it? What constitutes sufficient appropriate evidence in some areas? Are there some disclosures that aren't auditable? We tried to put that one on the back burner, but it just kept coming back, and there were different views on that issue. So the need to be talking about that in that multi-stakeholder environment seems to us to be very important in finding practical additional guidance for auditors, because they aren't just audit issues. A lot of them are preparer and regulatory issues as well. The other issue, and I think it was coming up a little bit, but I was reflecting earlier this week, the Financial Stability Board issued their peer review of risk disclosure practices. And it speaks, I think, a little bit to the boundaries of financial statements and the fact that they are getting a little bit blurred, because they were talking about the fact that these risk disclosures may exist in the notes to the financial statements. They may be in MD&A. They may be in the Pillar 3 disclosures. But the question they came out and asked was, what is the auditor's involvement? Should there not be an equivalent level of assurance respect to all of those risk disclosures, no matter where they are? And they challenged the IAASB to think about that and come up with some recommendations on how auditor involvement might be involved. But I think it does speak to this issue that the boundaries of the financial statements are blurring with some of these information that run across some of these various ways that it gets disclosed. So another aspect to think about in respect to disclosures.
Okay, we have three tent cards up, so we'll try and go through those and then close out this topic. Lynn Turner.
We've been auditing footnotes as a profession for a number of years. And so from that perspective, especially given since those footnotes have been complex for quite some period of time, we've had derivatives around for 3 decades. We've had off-balance sheet transactions for 3 decades. We've had a couple of great decades of financial engineering. It's not like as if this is brand new stuff and a rocket scientist. What I'm hearing here is that at least some people think there's just not enough time and perhaps not enough expertise devoted to auditing the footnotes. And my experience was the same as Sam's. The disclosure checklist did start with the junior people, quite frankly, but on the significant items, a partner did go through and get involved, probably the concurring partner as well. However, given the lack of adequate disclosures here, especially with respect to related party transactions, off-balance sheets, risk and uncertainties, it does seriously call into question why those disclosures didn't get made. And I think the bigger issue here is not the issue of where we got too many disclosure, because investors can use electronic tools to get through this stuff and do these days anyway. The issues, the problems have been the fact that there wasn't a disclosure made that was a material disclosure that should have been made to prevent the financial statements from being misleading. And the SEC, both in the 33 and 34 Act rules, have had a rule on their books going back to the 60s saying very clearly that if you need to make a disclosure to prevent the financials from being misleading, it needed to be made. Unfortunately, the FASB doesn't have anything similar to that. Given the response Neary got on the FASB's willingness to really move through the disclosure project, my guess is Neary will be retired by the time we get that done. I certainly wouldn't wait for the FASB project. I think this is something the PCAOB should go ahead and move on. The need to audit footnotes aren't going to wait for the FASB to finally get something done, and God knows it's taken them long enough to redo leases. We're talking about leases when we knew there was a problem in 75, so I'd urge you to go ahead. But I do think the issue isn't auditing disclosures or how the things that get disclosed. The issue is, why was it that something wasn't disclosed that should have been disclosed, and are the auditors looking for those type of things and ensuring somehow that they get made? Because that's where they get in trouble. That's where the investors suffer the losses. And so I'd certainly, as you write it, devote whatever you're going to work on, a significant portion of it to that focus, in addition to making sure that whatever is in there is accurate, correct as well, and complete.
Yeah, to your point, did investors really understand the nature of off-balance sheet exposures, even though there were requirements for disclosures there? Or did they really understand the nature of concentrations of credit risk, even though there were certain dangerous concentrations of credit risk, so on and so forth? And that's why we have this question here, and I suspect that's why the IWSB has its paper as well, to explore these issues. So thanks for those comments, Lynn. And next is
Damon Silver.
Yeah, I want to pick up where Lynn left off, but also just an observation. I mean, we closed before lunch, and we heard that at least some folks thought that really we shouldn't be looking to the numbers in the financial statement to tell us, for example, about impaired assets, that was too much to ask. And I got the feeling that now we were hearing that while we wouldn't look to the numbers in the financial statement for meaningful information, we're also not looking to the narratives for meaningful information. So I began to wonder whether I'd missed something. I was in the wrong room or the wrong meeting. And I was very grateful to Sam Ranzilla, who I thought made clear that, no, in fact, we actually are looking for meaningful information here, and that's well understood by auditors as well as by investors. I think what Lynn said about this is, of course, the obvious truth, that as long as there have been audited financial statements, there have been words as well as numbers, and that those words are necessary in order to make the financial statement what the auditor's opinion letter says it is, and that as a consequence, you cannot audit a financial statement without auditing the words as well as the numbers. I think everybody knows that. So why are we having this conversation in the way we're having it? And I think there's something very deeply troubling about it, and this is what I think it is. I think the general drift of what has occurred in relationship to public company auditing as a result of the financial crisis is very different from what occurred, and I'm now old enough and have been around long enough to remember all of this quite clearly, is very different from what occurred in the aftermath of Enron and WorldCom and the events that brought this body, the PCAOB, into being. And it's very sadly different, I think. I think after the Enron and WorldCom episode, there was a feeling that there had been a serious collapse in a set of institutions and arrangements and in a profession that we had relied upon to ensure the fair and efficient workings of our capital markets, and that therefore we were going to do something about it. And I think that feeling was fairly widespread, although obviously people disagreed about what exactly was going to be done. I think that feeling was fairly widespread, that it was a big and important problem that the system of public company financial disclosure and the auditing thereof had failed, and that the profession of public auditing had failed, and that things had to be done. And one of the reasons why, and that one of the things that was done was this body was created. And I remember the environment that attended the initial meetings of this body, the SAG, and it was an environment in which that was considered a very serious problem, a problem which in certain respects unified particularly auditors and investors around the need to do something. Now, I think sadly enough, and I hope that this is not a permanent feature of our political process, but I think at the moment what has happened in relationship to public to public accounting and to auditing as a result of the events of the last couple of years has been that the process is effectively becoming irrelevant, and that the and that the aftermath, now that we the Dow is sort of kind of around 12,000 again, and now that various bodies without benefit of any real hard data pronounce various institutions to be sound, and everyone's fat and happy again, or at least everyone who's in the interstices of the financial system. I won't speak to the 15 million unemployed or the 13 million people facing the loss of their homes or the people who pay my salaries and what they are facing in this country right now. But a certain portion of us are all fat and happy. That the general conclusion here is very similar to the kind of environment that we had in 2005 and 2006 and 2007. And that it's, but that it's not this notion of, it's not the deregulatory agenda of 2005 and 2006 and 2007. It's the agenda of irrelevancy. It's the agenda that we're just going to push all of these processes off the stage, and somehow we don't need them. I think that is what is going on here, and I think part, and I think the other side of the coin is that they are just simply too dangerous. That we have told ourselves a series of lies about our financial system and our economy. We are living fat and happy on those lies temporarily for now. And a financial accounting system and auditing system that actually functioned would make it impossible to indulge in those lies. Now that's an awful lot to put, that's an awful lot of burden to put on this particular subject. But I think I think once you start asking the question of why are people suggesting that it doesn't really matter, that neither the numbers nor the text mean anything, that it's got to have a deeper meaning than simply the usual kind of go-round that occurs in Washington. So I'll leave you all with that.
Chairman Doty, I think you have a comment.
Well, I'm stimulated by that. I agree with the historiography as far as it goes, and I'm challenged by the conclusion. I think first, I do think that what brought this board into being and the collapse that we saw, or the crisis, the scandal we saw at the time of Enron was fundamentally different. It was a Main Street scandal. And auditing has been deeply involved in Main Street, in the reporting of Main Street, and the fact that the board comes in to history the way it does is absolutely understandable. I think the second scandal, though, Damon, is I'm a big fan of Robert Samuelson, and I think he was right when he said what we had was the failure of a financial system that had been accorded validity because it had the responsibility for allocating capital. It told us when a company that said it needed $5 million was entitled validly to go to the public and raise $5 million, because then the underwriting system had looked at what it planned to do with it. It looked at the management they had in place, the business plan. It decided that they, in fact, could spend the $5 million properly. That's what failed. And what happened was that Wall Street, for reasons that are amply described in all the different books that we've been reading, ceased to perform that fundamental function. It's a function John Whitehead wrote about and talked about in Forming Goldman Sachs in the beginning, and we all know that. What we're seeing, I think, is not an admission of irrelevance or paralysis in the face of this. And on the contrary, I think what all of this is about is recognition that auditing and the board are in a new phase, that this is phase two for the board. It is post Welltech. It's post many things for the auditing profession, post-Welltech, post-Penn Central, post-you name it, certainly post-Enron, and we're now post the financial crisis, and therefore, how do we make auditing come to grips with exactly what people are wrestling with here, which is the non-quantitative aspects of full and fair financial disclosure. I don't have any doubt that the members of the Standing Advisory Group have articulated the ways in which that can be achieved. I do think that that from Denny and FASB on down to this end of the table, there have been many good ideas put out on how it can be achieved. I have no doubt that there will be change, that what you're seeing is a recognition around the table that what the vehicle will be, what the rules are going to be, and how the change is going to be articulated is yet to be clear. But I don't think there's any doubt that the audit profession is fully capable of dealing with the challenges presented when a financial system betrays us, when a financial model collapses. I mean, this is the collapse of a kind of financing model. Steve and I argue all the time about whether Europe is ahead of us or we're ahead of Europe. I happen to think we're ahead of Europe. It's an interesting argument to keep tabs of, but it's a good moment, I think, to transition to Steve. I don't want to presume on the chairman's on the chief auditor's function here, but I do think we're about to get our teeth into this question of where the disclosures ought to be, what the rules ought to be that drive the disclosures. So I think you should sleep well tonight, Damon, because it's not – people aren't – there's no abdication in the room. There's no sense of abdication.
I'm pleased to hear that. I will sleep well.
And thanks for those comments. And, Arnie, you have the last word on this subject as we're going to take a short break afterwards for our final discussion.
So this is two or three times now. I've got the last word.
You are the man.
I'll tell you.
So, set it up this way intentionally.
Well, I've listened to all this dialogue, and none of my colleagues around the table who are preparers have jumped in on this thing. But, you know, we're the ones that have responsibility for the financial statements. They are our financial statements. We're the ones who are responsible for developing and writing the footnotes and the appropriate disclosures. It's not the auditor's responsibility to write our footnotes for us. And I think we've lost sight of all that. And so we preparers, or at least my perspective as a preparer, is that I have a primary responsibility to make sure that my financial statements are in accordance with GAAP and they follow all the appropriate disclosures. At least my personal experience is that the checklists start out in my staff. We take the checklist. We put together packages to document the footnotes, and included in that package is the checklist that ENY uses. And we have to go through, and my staff knows that they have to indicate in that checklist whether or not they've covered the disclosure, and if they haven't, why they haven't, and if it's material or not material. Then it goes to the ENY auditors for review. And it's not given necessarily to a junior staff person. It's given, it ultimately gets up to a manager, senior manager, or partner. And then we engage in some reasonable dialogue and some healthy tension at times if they take exception to some of the disclosures. And then we get resolution. And then ultimately the SEC has some oversight. And trust me, we've all received SEC letters on our disclosures over the years. And then you engage in dialogue with them. So I think what we're trying to do here, I'm not sure what problem we're trying to solve, but we ought to try to get to the root cause of the problem, but I'm not sure it lands on the heels of the auditors. Preparers have the ultimate responsibility, not the auditors. So with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Well, difficult to articulate the problem, but I think it's been said around the table that, to some extent, many have felt that disclosures haven't been adequate. To Judge Friendly's point, that they need to sometimes go beyond GAAP and say what has to be reported in order for those financial statements to present fairly. So we think it's an important topic in terms of, obviously, we know it's the preparer's responsibility, but that auditors do an appropriate job of auditing disclosures. We think we've improved that framework in the risk assessment standards. We're going to continue to look at it. We're looking at the IAASB paper as well, and we'll talk some more about this in future subjects. Thanks, everybody, for a very lively
dialogue around the auditing disclosures. We're a bit behind schedule. We do want to give some additional time to the auditor's reporting model. As I said, this is the last chance we have to get input from you all before we put together our concept release. So can I ask you to take about a 10-minute break, get a refreshment, and get back here in about 10 minutes, and we'll get onto that topic. Thank you.